You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. A late-day market sell-off. Major indices all taking a sharp leg lower late in the session as tensions between Israel and Iran ramp up. The headlines that send stocks tumbling and what they mean for your money. Plus, Meta managing to hold on to gains after touching a new record high earlier in the session. Shares of the social media giant has added more than $430 billion in market cap just this year. Can the momentum continue? We'll debate that. And later, the next big thing for GLP-1 drugs. New studies seeing hopeful signs for treating Parkinson's disease. What it could signal for the space and the stocks poised for gains. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. We start off with that late day sell-off that took markets sharply lower. The Dow ending the day down 530 points, posting its biggest one-day loss since March of last year. It had been up nearly 300 points at its highs. The Nasdaq and S&P 500 also dropping more than a percent. It got ugly just after 2 p.m. Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari warning that if inflation continues to move sideways, it, quote, makes me wonder if we should cut rates at all this year. Adding to the concerns, rising tensions between Israel and Iran, which sent oil prices to their highest levels since October. So could these two risks in tandem put a cap on market optimism, which has been fueling us higher this year?
Well, 15 and a half hours, 8:30 tomorrow morning, the entire thing could change on a jobs number. So with that said, yeah, I believe so. And I think this today was sort of a continuation of March 8th. You're like, what are you talking about? The market didn't, you know, the market didn't do anything on that Friday, March 8th. But the intraday moves we saw in some of these names, specifically NVIDIA, to me, was really important. And quite frankly, NVIDIA has never recaptured the highs from that day. And a $250 billion market cap swing that day alone in one stock, to me, sort of set things in motion. The VIX has been hanging around. Last couple of days, you've seen a move in the VIX. Obviously, today, it moved significantly higher, but that's been telling you a story. And again, when you see a move of this magnitude intraday in the S&P, you have to take notice without question because you don't see it all that often.
Yeah, but fascinating. Yields didn't move today. And that was the thing earlier in the week when we got stocks selling off a little bit. It was because that move in the 10-year yield kind of shot up. There was like two consecutive days of 10 basis points, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot in the 10-year yield that was trading at 4.15 or something like that. So I think all of us earlier in the week would have said, listen, if we have this continued move up to maybe 4.5 or something like that, and that's kind of Guy's point. If we have a hot March jobs data tomorrow, we probably do have yields going up, and then you probably have a continuation of the sell-off in stocks. But Mel, I couldn't believe what you just said. We have not had a down 1.2 or whatever percent day in over a year in the S&P 500. And remember, we had 11% peak-to-trough sell-off from late July to late October, and that didn't incorporate more than a 1.5% move. So we have been operating in a very low-vol environment in the equity market, and at some point, there's going to be a little bit of pain that needs to be felt, no matter how bullish you are about stocks near-term.
Totally agree with Dan, actually, on that.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Right.
Should we pause?
We got that going for us just one time. Yeah.
You know, can I enjoy this?
A nice cooling off, a little bit of a correction. I think that's often good. I think what happened in bonds, though, later today was the flight to quality somewhat. Yeah. And so that's a bit noisy. But I think I guess what's the frothiest place out there is NVIDIA, I guess. So it makes sense to me that that would sell off. But even so, this isn't it hasn't been trounced completely. So I think if we do get in that really difficult environment, there's more to go in NVIDIA to the downside.
Yeah, that idea that big cap tech is your place to be when times are tough. I don't know. Today we saw the Philly Semiconductor Index down 3%. We saw communication services down, information technology down. Those are the sectors that led us lower here. So it didn't come through here, at least today, especially when you have not just Kashkari sort of underscoring those concerns that maybe we won't get three, maybe we'll get zero. And then you overlay with that the geopolitical tensions, which, by the way, is a CIA warning that Iran could attack Israel in the next 48 hours.
Well, yeah, and the geopolitics are really tough to handicap, but we talk about that on this desk, which is the dynamic here that I think if we could just keep it contained, I think we could maybe start to make heads and tails out of at least trying to handicap certain events. But I think this was six Fed officials that followed after Powell yesterday who put the wheels in motion. I mean, he called out his crew and said, I need to reinforce a message. And I think the Fed recognizes, let's not forget that the Fed targets financial conditions when they want them on the upside. They want to goose the wealth effect. They do it. They've done it before. And the flip side of that is the stock market's been out of control. So I thought the most interesting comments of the six that spoke today was probably, you know, Austin Goolsbee, who tends to be, you know, pretty dovish, and yet got in there and said, you know, things look not too bad. I think, you know, these two inflation prints from January and February, not that big a deal. But said, if these housing numbers don't improve, we're never going to get to 2%. When I, you know, you heard Mester, who ultimately came in there and typically has been one to be more dovish, said, I could wait a couple months. That really means probably she could wait longer. And then, of course, Kashkari, who used to be the biggest dove out there, now is the big hawk out there. So it's fascinating that the Fed and the conversation, that not just us, a lot of people in the market have been having for a month, is that maybe zero cuts. I think it's interesting. Yields can go lower before they could possibly even go higher. And at a day like today, the market thinks a couple steps ahead and says, look, if they're not going to do anything, we get it. We've got problems with inflation, but we will have problems with growth.
Yeah, the market might take some solace in the fact that Kashkari, he couldn't have been more wrong a couple years ago, so maybe he's equally wrong now. But we haven't, well, I shouldn't say we. I haven't been a fan. I've been on record. With all that said, defense stocks, big day today. And look at the move in crude oil on top of the move that we've been seeing. So that's making the Fed's job more difficult. Throw on top of that the recent move in copper, some of the soft commodities that we've talked about, and then you have an understanding as to why it's very difficult to lower rates in this environment. And yields, to Karen's point, I think the reason why they did go down today was this perceived or the perception of a flight to quality.
The bar is very high in terms of March. The inflation data for the month of March coming in better than January and February, yes, in that it should be lower. And now I don't know if we're going to see that, considering we had this sort of swing that there's no reason for it to come down at this point.
Yeah, think about the last few years, though, some of the inputs or some of the causes of higher inflationary sort of things, right? It has been geopolitical, right? So right. We go back to early 2022. We go to some of the stuff that's going on in the Red Sea. So if there is some sort of situation, and again, you know, it feels like we had not been talking about this Iranian threat, you know what I mean? Especially as the war in Gaza kept on going and going, that sort of thing. I mean, that, anything that happens in reaction to that, save from the horrible human effects of that, is going to be inflationary for the globe, you know what I mean? Whether it's energy, whether it's food, whether it's, you know, that sort of thing. So to me, like, that is that when we talked about this a little bit last night, it was like usually in these periods, right, when we come from these like kind of rate hiking to pausing, and then when they start to cut, we go back, you know, to 2000, 2001, you go back to 7-8, you go back to 2020. These are things that we could not have foreseen. And we know that there's plenty of geopolitical hotspots out there, but this would be a very different situation because in those prior three times, we were not dealing with inflationary pressures to the upside. If anything, they were to the downside. And that's what's different this time.
Right. And then, of course, under all of this is if we do get embroiled somehow in some sort of conflict, is that even more reason for the Fed not to cut? Because you want to save some dry powder for a time when the economy might actually need it. I don't know. It's a very complicated sort of mosaic.
Right, it is. I mean, well, particularly what Dan's saying is true. If we get mired in that and that causes additional
inflation,
then yes, why cut?
And just to remind folks, and this isn't my political view, this isn't anything, but the fact is if the U.S. is taking a hotter line stance with Israel, that throws into question a lot of political kind of givens in the world and historically, and I think that's part of the volatility around this. So I look at also some of the relationships. Guy started to talk about the things that did well and things that didn't do well. As an energy investor, I don't love this kind of price action, okay? And energy, actually, XLE, which was cruising going into the morning, didn't really respond too well to this kind of news. So I don't think we love price spikes in the energy space. I think what we've liked are really the dynamics around some of the fundamentals in the sector. I do look at the broader market dynamics here and say, look, today was an interesting day, and we talk about the geopolitics. I think this was all about the Fed. And was today the day, because we've said
you
this for a
this
while.
Move today was about the Fed?
I think it was all about
the Fed.
Fed.
I mean, we've had people coming out, Bostic yesterday, Gorman, I mean, a number.
Zero or
saying
less
no
than
cuts
three.
Or
but,
one
but we,
cut.
But we had six Fed officials today who basically reiterated what Powell said yesterday.
I thought was more dovish.
Well, what I'm going to tell you is I think we've questioned why equities haven't responded to the dynamic that actually there might not be rate cuts this year when, in fact, they've priced in six or three or whatever. And at some point, equity markets have to respond. I think, I mean, I'm not making light of the geopolitics. I already brought it up. But I do think this was a broken record by the Fed today.
But part of the conversation that we've had here is the answer to the question of what would the markets do if we said tomorrow that there would be no cuts? And we all said, not all, but many people said that the markets would do fine because that means that growth is actually intact. That story remains intact. So what is different today? If that is, if it's the Fed today, what is the difference between today and
before? Because the Fed's data dependent, but they're not data dependent. They're kind of saying, we're going to wait either way. We're scared to death about, you said this yesterday, we can't cut too soon. I do agree with what guys said, too. You're making a great point to remind us that we said a zero-cut environment means that the economy is better. But a zero-cut environment also means that the Fed is boxed into a corner, and we actually could have slower growth and stagflation. And that's what the market did today. Look what bond yields did and look what equities did, and that's stagflation.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the cuts are because something's breaking, right? And the bulls will say they can cut this time because nothing's breaking. Things are moving along really nicely, and they can start to, I don't want to say normalize rates because I don't think lowering rates is anything near normal, but they can do that because there's nothing to stop them, right? The economy's doing well, unemployment's under control, all those things. That's the best case scenario. But I don't think, see, that's the thing. I don't think that's what's going to happen. If they lower rates, it's because something is breaking along the way. And you're starting to see, I don't know, signs of that today. And real quick, in terms of energy, Tim makes a great point. If we have an XLE chart or an ExxonMobil or Conoco, I mean, both these names, Exxon and Conoco, are right up against prior all-time highs. The laggard has been Chevron, which made its all-time high right around the time, if you recall, I think it was November of 22, when it announced a $75 billion stock buyback. That marked the top. But these stocks are right there. I think they're going to go through, but I can understand why you might want to take money off the table.
All right, let's get more on the move and oil prices. WTI trading above 86 bucks a barrel, Brent climbing above 90, both at their highest since October. For more on this, let's get to CNBC's Pippa Stevens. Pippa.
That's right, Melissa. Brent settling above 90 for the first time since October as fears of a wider conflict in the Middle East spooks the oil market after Iran vowed retaliation following a missile strike on its consulate in Damascus. When asked earlier today if the CIA warned Israel about an Iranian plan to attack within 48 hours, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said, quote, they did talk about a very public and very viable real threat by Iran to Israel's security. BOK Financial's Dennis Kistler said the retaliatory actions will most likely involve the oil complex in some manner, whether it strikes against more Red Sea shipping lanes or directly on the Strait of Hormuz, which is adding fears that it will disrupt transportation of crude oil and oil products. Melissa?
Any guesses at this point, Pip, on what the impact to Brent would be?
I think at this point we have to see if any infrastructure is actually hit and the nature of any retaliatory actions. I think after Russia first invaded Ukraine, there was a lot of fear in the market that all of a sudden supplies would be disrupted, which is why we saw prices get above 130. That did not end up happening. So I think this time around there is more hesitation to jump fully in. But clearly the market right now is saying maybe this is a little bit more of an issue for oil than previously thought.
All right. Pippa, thanks. Pippa Stevens. We were just talking about the spike in oil. We're better off just having a high level of oil and not a spike. But
no, and that's the points Tim making. I mean, I still think it's going to be, I think it's going to wind up bullish for the energy complex and XLE, but I understand. And quickly, defense stocks. I mean, throw up a Lockheed Martin, for example. Good day today on the back of what's been a good couple of weeks. So I think defense stocks have been trying to tell you something along the way as well.
So you're saying if tomorrow we wake up and nothing's really happened, do you think then oil will retrace entirely? Or do you think there's going to be some level of elevated oil?
I think oil wants to go to these levels. It's been on that trajectory for a while. It got sort of fast-tracked today. But I think whether it happened today or a week from now, 2 weeks from now, I think that's where we're going. Tim's point about, you know, this is not the environment where you want necessarily, but I understand that. But this rabbit's been out of the hat for a while.
It's more that if you're investing in energy equities, you don't really like a spike in oil because it's never given the benefit of the doubt. And so energy equities, I think, have been moving higher on a combination of steadier oil prices. You know, whatever you believe OPEC can and cannot do in terms of controlling supply, you believe that these companies are in a pretty good spot and that actually the biggest integrated oil companies for the last 3 years have been paying down debt and putting themselves in a very defensive position in terms of their dividends.
All right. Meantime, Meta eking out a gain in spite of today's sell-off, the stock hitting a record $530 during the session after catching three fresh analyst upgrades. Mizuho naming it a top pick for April, while both RBC and Jefferies hiked their price targets. Jefferies saying it expects Meta to capture 50% of incremental ad dollars in 2024. That's well above the 33% it got in 2023. So very bullish here. We saw that it was up as much as, I think, 4+% during the session, Karen.
Yeah, I mean, I like that. That was that's sort of the headline number of the piece. But also what it says is that so earnings will go up, of course, yes. But then it has a 23 multiple, which is really not a very, you know, expensive multiple for a company like this. So that was the base case, that 585 target.
Right.
And in fact, they had a $715 bull case, the upside case, and I think 375 on the downside. But there's a lot to like there. And that didn't even include the cash.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. And this stock gapped up 20% after it reported its Q4 results and gave this guidance. And so here we are. We're trading at all-time highs. And again, I think the valuation story, I think what they've done, rationalizing costs, how they're using generative AI, like all this stuff, it's all there and it's cheap. I get it. But I just think it becomes incrementally that much harder to kind of surprise the way they did to the upside from an all-time high, near an all-time high last quarter. And the other side of this is, like, you know, Alphabet's kind of stuck in the mud. You know, Alphabet hasn't had that moment. They've had two consecutive disappointing quarters, two disappointing guides, a couple disappointing launches of their generative AI or whatever. And so it's as high as the expectations are getting for Meta, they're getting very low for Alphabet. And that could set up really interesting as we get through, let's say, a couple rocky weeks of volatility possibly and get into earnings, because to me, these could set up as decent pairs trades in the near term.
Right. When you talk about Alphabet, isn't it because they're trying to sell basically an AI product, and Meta is just trying to benefit its business with AI. And that was
which is working
in terms of selling ads for Reels. It's working for a lot of different things, Advantage Plus. And so that's sort of the thesis. So it's interesting to think about AI as a product, and some companies are benefiting from that. And then this is just the application of AI to one's business, which is probably what we're going to see a lot more for a lot of the other companies outside the Mag 7.
You know, Karen talks about this a lot, when stocks should or shouldn't be at certain levels. So if you would take away that obviously huge drawdown in Facebook, most of it because of their own mistakes, and just looked at this stock, you'd be like, it makes perfect sense that it's here. But we're looking at it through the context of this ridiculous run that it's had from the low, so it looks like parabolic move. But with that said, 21 times next year's numbers ish, right? You're probably talking about, I don't know, 15% EPS growth, 12% revenue growth or so. And as Karen said, but that's without the cash. So there's nothing not to like here other than the fact it's had this tremendous move higher.
Yeah, it's interesting that we can say at 21, 22 times it's not expensive. It's not. But that didn't matter when it was 14 times. So, you know, it really just tells you that I think they're in the sweet spot in terms of where, first of all, this was a company that everybody knew about, what the DAUs, the MAUs, whatever you're tracking, that this base of customers is so powerful. If they could, it's a cash flow machine. If they could ever decide just to be a company that wanted to generate free cash flow, well, they said, we're going to go out there and do it. And then they also had core businesses they were working on that really are benefiting from AI. I'll say this about Google. I mean, I look at that chart. There's nothing about that chart that bothers me at all. I still think Google is one of these names. I mean, it's been easy to malign them, and it's understandable. But again, as they begin talking about pricing or not pricing, what AI could mean for their core business, I think there's catalyst there.
Do you think that it's not good that Meta is not going to do much better from here because of the run that it's had?
No, I think you make a really good point. The way that they built this llama, this model, it's open source. There's going to be a lot of applications that are built in and around that, but that's something that is, you know, like in the making here. What they're doing right now for their own ad product is the thing that I think has been realized. It's been realized in that guidance. So I don't really have a strong sense. I just think it's interesting that there was a few analysts out today and they were talking the same way they were about Meta, and they were all kind of downbeat a little bit on Alphabet. And the one thing I'll just say is, if Google were to do this deal that was rumored a couple weeks ago, something with Apple, you know what I mean? This could be a really interesting time at a really interesting valuation, at a really interesting sentiment level for this stock right here. So that's the way I'm thinking about it. I think Meta, if you're there, fantastic. If you're not in Alphabet, there might be an opportunity. But even if it gaps down on its third consecutive miss and guide down, it's probably not a bad do at that point also.
Coming up, the battle's been won, but now what? Disney CEO Bob Iger weighing in after coming out on top in the Nelson Peltz proxy battle, and now he's setting his sights on the media giant's next big hurdle. More on that next. And some stock moves catching our traders' eyes, a potential tech deal, a casino call, and a food processor plunging. We've got it all when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Disney CEO Bob Iger speaking exclusively to our David Faber after he won the months-long proxy battle with activist investor Nelson Peltz of Trian Partners. He discussed what the company's priorities are now.
Now what we have to do is turn it not just into a profitable business, into a growth business, a business that has margins that this company and our shareholders would really
double-digit
be
margins
proud of.
Then, right?
Eventually, yes, double-digit margins, of course. The way to do that is actually very, very clear to us. It's very, very clear that we need more engagement in terms of consumers spending time on the platform.
But despite his loss yesterday, Peltz said he is not backing away from advocating for change at the media and entertainment giant.
I hope Bob can keep his promises. I hope they can do all the things they assured us they were going to do. And we'll only watch and wait. If they do it, they won't hear from me again. If they don't, Jim, you may be seeing me on your show next year doing this same thing again.
So can Disney succeed in its execution plans? I mean, he at least right now hopes so. He's got a $3.5 billion stake at last filing.
Well, yes. And he's going to continue both because this is what he does for a living. He's got a lot on the line on this one. But I any expectation that you're going to have a different outcome today, I think, was off base. I think this isn't a real surprise. It's also interesting to hear Bob Iger say, you know, now we have to do like as if, you know, suddenly now that this is out of the way, you know, suddenly everything becomes a lot clearer. I think he said, you know, some of these messages have been sent for months now in terms of costs and profitability dynamics. And I think that last quarter of earnings has as much to do about where the stock is than this proxy fight.
Yeah, I think so. It was a great interview. I mean, David really pushed him hard and on a lot of different things. One that I thought was interesting, it's not so newsy, but the idea that they hope to be number two in streaming. He didn't really say it like that, but that right. was sort of the way David framed it. And it's over, right? Netflix has won. So they're hoping to be number two. You wouldn't think Bob Iger would say, we're going to turn this around. We're going to make be number two. Well, they're already, but don't
they have a lot of other levers? When you think about Netflix is trying to get into live, right? And they might be bidding for sports. And if you think about the thing that they're trying to fix and they're trying to monetize is that ESPN in a way. So to me, I think that like it's kind of easy to just say, okay, we're number two. But at the end of the day, if he's successful in transforming this business and getting to some of those things, they're going to probably do something a little bit better and they're going to be in a better spot than Netflix to kind of do something horizontally, in my opinion, on the streaming front. But again, and I'll just say this about the stock, you know, after that quarter that Tim just mentioned, the stock gap from 100 to 110 consolidated a little bit. This proxy fight started. It went to above 120 or so. If it were to come back, by the time you get to their earnings in early May, it could set up as a great thing. They're not going to lay an egg on that next quarter. Like, think about that. If when Bob Iger's on that thing, so you almost
his last quarter was the one where they couldn't lay an egg.
Well, that one too, sure. but I mean, he's got a little honeymoon period, a little coverage. But I'm just saying, like, if this thing were to come back in towards 110, then it sets up as a great entry point, in my opinion.
The interesting day for me will be April 18th. So Netflix reports on the 18th. Stock has had a huge run. We've talked about as it gets towards 32, 33 times next year's numbers. Historically, that's when it starts getting expensive. And we're pretty close to that now. The prior all-time high is probably another $50 or so from here. So If Netflix stalls but Disney hangs in, that's a bit of a tell here. So I'm one of these people, I think Tim might agree. I think you stay long Disney here and their earnings in early May.
All right. There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
A potential tech deal, gambling on a casino stock, and a potato processor getting fried. How our traders are handling today's big moves and Wall Street calls. Plus, big hopes for small caps. Why our next guest sees a turnaround on the horizon and where you can set your sights within the space. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this. From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks staging a late-day sell-off on geopolitical tensions and rate cut concerns. The Dow dropping more than 500 points. It's now on pace for its worst weekly loss since March of last year. The S&P and NASDAQ both falling more than 1%. Meantime, shares of HubSpot jumping today after reports that Alphabet might make an offer on the online marketing software company, which had a market cap of about $31 billion as of yesterday's close. The potential deal would be Alphabet's largest ever. And shares of Lamb Weston having its worst day ever, after the French fry maker missed on earnings and reduced its outlook, blaming weak snack demand. And Mizuho betting big on Wynn. Analysts at the firm initiating the casino stock with a buy rating and slapping a $131 price target on the name, 24% higher from current levels. The stock had been up nearly 4% at its highs, but closed down slightly. I don't know.
Well, I heard Lamb was down 20%, uh-huh. and I said, why? And some said potatoes.
French fries.
I thought it was Lamb Research.
LRCX. No, LW.
Okay, I'm not so familiar with LW. I mean, little more now.
They make like the frozen French fries.
Is it a Zempic thing? Is that what is happening?
I don't know. They said less of a demand for snacking, but it's been going on for some time, so I don't know if this is like a new thing or not. I'm not as well-versed in the snack area.
You just pointed at me when you started talking about snacking.
I know, I mean, you like to snack.
I'm not afraid to snack. Sure. Snack? I mean, I'm not a French fries guy as much as, like, I'd go Cheetos right now if you waved a bag of those hot ones in front of me.
The Flamin' Hots?
Flame, of course. Or those Takis?
Dangerous.
Our friend Tillman, he might be watching the show.
Cheetah.
You know this.
Of course.
I mean, I think it was on our show this is a while ago, his stake in Wynn, remember, you recall.
Yeah. We're actually going to talk about a real stock as opposed to snacking. Thank you. I'll talk about snacking if you want.
No, because
you're getting us back on track.
Well, I'm known to do that from time to time. But look at this stock. I mean, this is the highest the stock's been, I think, since August. Yes, it sold off late in the day like everything else, but again, this is one I think you want to stay with it on the long side. They report, I think, on May 5th, 4th or so. Stay long win for sure here, Melms.
Chances Alphabet can buy a company that's worth $31 billion in market cap.
Probably not great. More importantly,
it's
13 times sales. Their sales are 10% of that of Google's. It's an 84% gross margin business at HubSpot, but they still lose money on a GAAP basis. So, like, to me, when you have to fix this generative AI thing and you're battling some absolute behemoths, whether it be Microsoft and Amazon and OpenAI and the list goes on, you got to get this thing right. So this seems like it would be a distraction. And hopefully the market's speaking a little bit and helping them come to the conclusion that they shouldn't make this acquisition.
Coming up, still hanging on to Macy's, the department store chain down 4 days in a row as store closures weigh on the stock. But one of our traders isn't letting go just yet. They will explain why. And will we see a small cap comeback? Our next guest will lay out why he is seeing big things out of the group and the sectors that could lead the charge. Fast Money's back in two.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Well, Welcome back to Fast Money. It hasn't been all bad news for small cap stocks this year. Take a look at restaurants like Shake Shack gaining 35% since January, and newly public Cava, that's up nearly 50%. The names are among the favorites of our next guest, who predicts a bigger recovery in small caps. Greg Torto is a small cap portfolio manager at Goldman Sachs Asset Management. He runs a firm's small cap core equity ETF listed under ticker GSC. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the picks, because we do want to get to them, in terms of the rate environment, what do small caps need at this point?
Yeah, you saw a little bit in the fourth quarter when the rates declined to in the 370s. You saw small caps respond very, very positively. I think other financial conditions have eased a bit, which is also helpful for small caps. And I do think that a little bit more rate clarity will be a nice tailwind for the group. We may not get that this week, but I think it's something that we should get more likely in the second quarter.
Okay. Let's talk about what you like. And you like the consumer sector. You're all bulled up, you say, about the consumer. Why? What do you see that is so convincing to you that the consumers will continue to spend?
I think the consumer has chosen, very, very broadly with their feet in terms of how they spend their money. And you mentioned two of them. We like the restaurant theme a lot. And Shake Shack and Cava are two of them, two companies that are really focused on not just menu, but loyalty. And they're run by management teams that have been very, very efficient on the real estate side of things. Shake Shack has, went through its own troubles before they kind of corrected themselves. And we think the new management team will be helpful there. But Cava has, really learned from the mistakes of the past. And I think that's one that's set up quite well for the future.
Full disclosure, I worked at Shake Shack. I have to say that, right?
That's true.
And we've been collectively bullish. But how do you wrap your head around valuation? Because it is not a cheap stock at these levels.
I think that there's a bit of under-earnings, in what's gone on there. And I think that what you'll see as we move forward is a bit bigger ticket. And I think you're going to get a little bit more on the growth side in terms of units that are out there. I think that they're a bit behind the curve on units as they waited for the management change to go through. So it's on present numbers, it's not cheap at all. But I do think if you look out 2 years and you start to see something that more aligned with the growth rate that we're looking for.
Greg, we obviously spent a lot of time talking about debating, as everyone is right now, about inflation, inflationary inputs and the like here. When you think about your sector, they're obviously, a bit more sensitive, let's say, to larger cap stocks, and especially with higher rate environment and the like here. What's your outlook right here? And obviously, you pick small caps, you put them in your ETF here. We spent a lot of time looking at the Russell 2000, which is 2000 stocks here. But are you optimistic about a broader swath of stocks rather than the ones you're just looking at?
Yeah, I think that what we try to look at is, within the Russell 2000, you have a lot of stuff that you probably don't want to own. There's a significant amount of unprofitable companies. You had a large number of SPACs in there for a long period of time. That's starting to slowly drift away. You have a lot of rate-sensitive companies that we don't really kind of get into in the REITs and the utilities and things like that. So if you look at some of the names that not necessarily are at the largest part of the benchmark, but in the sort of the $2 to $5 billion range, where you can find some of the companies that can make their own weather. Mentioned consumer. We like the semiconductor space a lot. I do think that some of the areas in healthcare, some med tech names that we like. These are companies that have gone through an earnings recovery that started to go down 2 years ago before the large cap guys. So I think that these companies can respond favorably, as some of the tailwinds and headwinds balance out a little bit more. But I do think that you have to be very selective in small caps because things can go down with great velocity.
In semiconductors, do you need to see the NVIDIA story slow down in order for that specific subsector to do well? I mean, are these, AI sort of semiconductor stocks or AI adjacent?
AI adjacent, I'd say. I think that some of the companies we own, there's a company went public a few weeks ago called Astera Labs that we invested in. We knew the company, for a couple of years before they went public, so we were eager to invest in that one. And then other companies like Cohu and Onto Innovation, we think can benefit from just a large recovery in chips and things like high bandwidth memory, which is an analog to NVIDIA's growth. You need that high bandwidth memory to make those AI machines hum.
Greg, thanks for stopping by.
Thank
Great
you for having me.
You. Greg Torto, Goldman Sachs Asset Management. Karen, where are you in small caps?
Well, I like them, and I've been surprised that they haven't done better, right? There was that, false dawn. Maybe it's still somewhat dawnish, but Shake Shack is interesting. Cava is also interesting. Crazy, great management team. Great. I mean, Ron Shake is, big holder and the chair of the board. But, oh, my God, are these stocks expensive.
Red Dawn was a great movie.
It was unbelievable.
Swayze. Booth, Leah Thompson.
No, it was a it was one of the great movies.
Okay, I'm sorry. Small caps. So I've gone out there and said, and first of all, Greg and the team, they do great work. So I just point out that a lot of times I feel like we pay more attention to small caps than we should in an environment where I think actually there is some question about growth. And so I've also mentioned that I believe sometimes small caps are a great hedge in a world where you actually think growth is under some question. And I've used that IWM on the short side in a world where I think we're worried about macro.
I know we got to go.
But you're going to say it anyway. I'm going to say it.
No, but to Tim's point, I'll take Swayze, Jennifer Grey, and Red Dawn over Swayze, Jennifer Grey, and Dirty Dancing every day of the week.
I forgot about Jennifer Grey in there, too.
Yeah,
and
Red Dawn.
Swayze's a legend. But
100%.
Leah Thompson.
I don't even
underrated.
Know what you're really talking about. It's going to go to break. Coming up, a department store downer. Macy's dropping nearly 8% this week, but one of our traders is still holding on. Why they are betting this name can still turn things around. Next, plus, can GLP-1 drugs treat Parkinson's? New clinical trial suggests it is possible. Dr. Kavita Patel will join us to break down a surprising new study that could help shape the future of the space. Welcome back to Fast Money. Macy's shares dropping for the fourth straight day, now down nearly 8% just this week. It's on pace for its worst week since November. The department store chain is also set to close more than a quarter of its 500 stores across the U.S. Despite the problems and the price action, one of our traders is still long this retailer. So, Karen, what's the bull case here?
Well, the bull case is the pressure has been ratcheted up. So 2 days ago, Arkhouse, which we know has been trying to become, they finally signed an agreement, allegedly, to allow them due diligence, and it's going more slowly than we thought. We have a quote here from their proxy fight, but it's basically saying it's taken months of public advocacy and the launch of a proxy contest to replace a majority of the board to motivate the company to do the right thing. So they're really putting pressure on the board. Another interesting thing in this filing was they have to show what purchases they've made, and they made three big purchases right before they signed the confidentiality. So at prices as high as 21.34, something like that, a fair amount of shares. So they really believe as recently as that, March 19th or whenever that purchase was, March 15th, that there was upside there even above that level. Macy's now needs to respond. They're in a full-on proxy fight now. They could lose control of the board.
Wow. Guy, you're pointing this out, too.
Well, I mean, the risk arbitrageurs out there like Karen, I mean, this, they have a field day with stuff like this. And just in risk reward, I think, but I would have said this at $20 to be clear, from the long side, I think you can play Macy's here. It's not just Macy's. I mean, Nordstrom's has a similar thing going on as well. So these companies are in play. So I think if you have some risk appetite, Macy's at 18 and a half bucks looks pretty interesting.
If for some reason,
I would have thought the same thing at 20. I did think the same thing.
Without the activist overlay, would the Macy's story in and of itself be attractive?
Probably not, but what's the downside, right? The question is downside versus up. Let's say it's 16 versus 24 or more. That was their latest bid. Now, Macy's could respond by, you know, we're up for sale.
Coming up, shares of Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly have been surging on the strength of the GLP-1 drugs. Could another potential use for these treatments give them an even bigger boost? We'll debate that. And here's a sneak peek at the Cramer Cam. Jim is chatting exclusively with the CEO of ConAgra. Catch the full interview at the top of the hour on Mad Money. Meantime, more Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money, a promising sign that GLP-1s may be used to slow down neurological diseases. A new phase 2 study published yesterday found that participants with early Parkinson's disease taking the GLP-1 Adlixin therapy had less motor disability than those using a placebo. There were, however, some gastrointestinal side effects. For more on this study, let's bring in Dr. Kavita Patel. She is the NBC News medical contributor. Dr. Patel, great to see you.
Thanks so much, Melissa. It is an interesting study.
Yeah. Lixisenatide, which is the active ingredient in this particular drug, it's actually discontinued in the United States.
Right.
And so I'm wondering how, and it's a daily injection, or it was a daily injection, and that's what they did in this study. Can we extrapolate these results to the GLP-1 drugs that are, you know, marketed today by Novo and Eli Lilly?
Yeah, I think it's an important kind of precedent that we need to watch, because we're seeing this not just in Parkinson's, but also a lot of the other diseases that you and I and the team have spoken about, cardiometabolic diseases in general. So I do think that this opens the door for thinking about linkages to neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's. And here's why. I think this is the disconnect that most people don't realize, that we know that there's a relationship between people who are diagnosed with diabetes and the propensity to demonstrate Parkinson's or Parkinson-like symptoms. So, Melissa, we know that there's some biologic relationship between that kind of insulin metabolic axis, and that's why GLP-1s can be very important. So while Adalixin did not make the cut for being kind of competitive on that weight loss and diabetes race with GLP-1s, that kind of mechanism of function in Parkinson's and this early promising data, remember, it's not reversing Parkinson's. So we're not trying to make the promises that it does with weight loss or changing the nature of diabetes, but even slowing down these symptoms for 12 months, that can be incredibly valuable to quality of life. And I do think that this has implications for Novo, for Lilly, and even for some of the other GLPs that we've been talking about, the oral ones, some of the other drugs that are in the makings in the pipeline.
Does this sort of revitalize the possibilities for Lixin in that, you know, it was taken off the market because it was not competitive? And now if this is actually an application, all of a sudden it's the Parkinson's drug.
Yeah, it is a really important application. I'm very eager. Look, you don't get an often what we call a New England Journal of Medicine high rigor, kind of a high bar that they set for the evidence threshold. So this met a number of those evidence thresholds and the scientific criteria from like the Data Safety Monitoring Board. So this gets not only kind of a green flag, but it points to what I think we've been talking about, whether it's liver disease, whether it's cardiac disease, which is why Medicare plans are covering the GLP-1 space. I feel like we're just still in this renaissance area. Is this going to be the fix it for all of these things? Not at all. But again, quality of life, much like we've talked about with other degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. Melissa, if you're talking to someone that has Parkinson's like I have, and you can talk about slowing these symptoms down at least 12 months, that's an incredible amount of quality of life for them. So this is we're learning more about this axis of metabolism and all the parts of our body in ways that I had not even had access to in medical school.
Dr. Patel, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. Thanks, so Karen. For these Parkinson's patients, how far along were they? What were these early symptoms or more later symptoms?
No, these were earlier symptoms. So this is definitely, I think, Karen, you're pointing out some very good caveats that this is not necessarily, I think a lot of us are very familiar with probably a lot of kind of higher profile celebrities, Michael J. Fox. There's a number of people with Parkinson's that we know in the public sphere at different degrees. These were earlier stage. So this is not late stage Parkinson's. And this was really looking at slowing down their symptoms. Again, not a reversal of Parkinson's. I think we still have to kind of caveat that, Karen. So I think it's one of these, it passed that threshold so that we saw clinical benefit. And I think going further, it's that question of now, could this be used as a primary indication for Parkinson's, which is what I would expect the company to seek.
Is there anything out of the study that would make you cautious? You know, the safety profile is good. I mean, that's a drug that's been on the market for a long time.
Right.
But it seemed that there were a high percentage of gastrointestinal effects, side effects, nausea, for instance. And if that makes it the bar even higher for, you know, to tell a patient, yeah, you can take this drug for 12 months and you can have a slowdown in disability, but you'll be nauseous. You have a 40% chance of being nauseous.
Yeah, I do think that those side effect profiles, and by the way, this is what the critics of the GLP-1 space have said, that we're even critics that have, you've talked to them, Melissa, that I think people have kind of glossed over these side effects. They are not trivial. When they do happen, they are serious and can be debilitating enough where people might say, I don't want those side effects. I'm willing to deal with the other side effects of my disease to not have the nausea. So I do, that does cause me pause. I wouldn't paint this as you should take this. This is so much better. The side effects are not that bad. People are overplaying them. And I think we've talked, Melissa, about extreme cases where you can see death and severe kind of GI distress, so that this is not something that I would do lightly. Usually people with Parkinson's, and going to Karen's point, kind of people at later stage Parkinson's can have other GI effects. So I think that's why you're seeing maybe a perhaps more pronounced effect in those patients. So this will be meant for a very specific patient profile. Even though Parkinson's affects many people, it's not going to be for everybody for that reason.
Dr. Patel, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Patel. Another application here for this quote-unquote miracle drug.
Which is remarkable. I mean, Karen can tell, I mean, you've been on the board for how long, Michael J. Fox? So it's remarkable without question. I mean, and the indications continue to come, which is great. But the questions I think we have collectively is, at what point for Lilly, for example, is the valuation just too stretched in this environment? That's the question you have to ask in earnings at the end of the month.
The other dynamic here is where you bring in more Medicare coverage. And so you have a, it just may be a way that the addressable market meets the insurance payment market in a place where the drug companies really have a bigger struggle on their hands. Because, again, the pricing here may be challenging.
All right. Up next, final trades. Final trade time. Tim.
Yeah, I like those upgrades. And when another place that has a lot of exposure to Macau, Las Vegas Sands, I still think that whole space, especially with Macau exposure, is very cheap.
Karen.
Yes, I agree with Dan a few times tonight.
What?
Actually, several. So
mark
I'm
the
going,
date.
Yes, Alphabet. The OG kind.
And I agree with Tim and Guy about Disney. I just think under any circumstance that stock sells off into that print in early May, I think you buy it.
NBC Page program, amazing. Mm-hmm. Our amazing. Page, Chloe.
Currently, yes, Chloe.
It's her birthday, so we got to give
her a happy birthday.
Look at that.
It's 23, I'm unbelievable. American Barrack, that comes out gold, Melms.
All right, thanks for watching Fast Money. Mad Money, Witch and Kramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.